A man who stands his ground and wins is better than one who runs away and cowers in hiding. He paused. Besides, he is infatuated with you. He desires you, and he will pursue any alliance that will bring you to his bed. Correct? At the very least, even though doubts will nag at him when he takes time enough to think it through. If he allows himself to be rational rather than emotional, where you are concerned, I'm not sure he can manage it. She laughed. I did not encourage him all that much, just enough to stir what is left of his youth. But an old man, even a king, holds no interest for me. Not even your favorite penetrator wields such power where you are concerned, he said wryly, to his regret. She rose. There are good reasons we cannot be more than we are, and you are well aware of them. Let it go for now, and perhaps one day things will change. She could see from his expression that he did not believe her, even if he could not help hoping it was so. But Coldray was not for her. He never had been, and he never would be. Rank, station in life, profession, and tradition all worked against him becoming anything more than a friend. As they walked back to the encampment, she found herself thinking suddenly of Darlie. He wasn't even a scar, and an illogical assessment would define him as an enemy. Yet thoughts of him came unbidden, and did so frequently. She could not manage to make herself forget him, even where any rational assessment of the prospects for a relationship said she must. If a partnering with Coldray was unlikely, one with Darlie was beyond imagining. But her heart wanted her to be wrong, wanted what was not possible to be possible. Throwing up barriers of logic and common sense did not change anything. In her young life it never had. If she wanted something badly enough, she always managed to find a way to get it. Why not here? She was indisputably attracted to him, and if he gave himself half a chance, he would feel the same toward her. She could not stop believing they could find a way to be something other than enemies. Her feelings, on which she always kept a tight wrap and which she'd come to trust, told her this was so. He is someone I could be partnered with. Never with Coldray, but possibly with Darkon Lee. I feel it down inside me where truths hide and wait to be discovered. I do not mistake them. She sensed Coldray looking at her, and she realized her face had gone hot and flushed. Everything is arranged? She asked abruptly, trying to distract herself. He nodded. We have our soldiers in place. We have our airships and weapons ready. When the time comes, we can act. We are risking everything, she said quietly, stopping suddenly and pulling him about to face her, hands gripping his arms to hold him fast. If this fails, we will be finished. Even if we survive, my father will abandon us, and my efforts to win his support will have been for nothing. We won't fail. You cannot know that. Listen to me, Arjin. We will not fail. Not you and I. Not our brave Scar. We will not fail. And when we succeed... He left the sentence unfinished. His sudden smile said it all. She smiled back. When we succeed, she echoed. 24. It was nearing sunset, 2 days later, and Araxin Dresch was standing on a hilltop, well back from the water's edge, watching as the Myrmidon churned against its banks in heavy swells, fed anew by rains that were falling farther west. He glanced skyward and could see a dark line of clouds moving in. It would reach their encampment soon and make the ensuing night an uncomfortable one for those caught out in it. Overhead, the sky was still bright blue and clear, although the light was beginning to dim as the sun gradually sank behind the storm front to his left, and the coming night made a stealthy advance from his right. He was alone at the moment, save for his personal guards, 2 soldiers who had served in this capacity for nearly 10 years now. It was a career choice as much as an honour. The men had been assigned not only because they had showed courage and strength in battle, but also because they had applied to enter into his personal service at the end of their 15-year tour of duty. And Stas and Rija He genuinely liked these men, and respected them, too. They served at his pleasure, but they were independent-minded and kept their eyes and ears open for indications of dissatisfaction within the army. They did not gossip, but they felt no compunction about reporting things that needed it. Their relationship with their fellow soldiers was strong, and their commitment to the betterment of the Federation Army thorough. He had told them recently that he would make them high-ranking officers and give them a portion of the autonomy he himself enjoyed. It was easy enough to find men willing to fight and die for the Federation. It was not so easy to find men smart enough to know how to avoid both. Footsteps coming up behind him caught his attention. He turned.
"Commander!"
Idaeus Presselin called out, approaching at a quick trot, a determined look on his rugged face. An aide and a bowman accompanied him, but as they neared the first commander, Presselin gestured for both to fall back. Whatever had brought him in such a hurry, he wanted to be alone with his superior to reveal it.
"Fresh news?"
Dresch queried as the other came to a stop before him. Without a word in response, his sub-commander handed him a tiny rolled piece of paper. Dresch took it from him, unfolded it, and gave the contents a quick read. "Araxian Dresch, First Commander of the Federation Army. Enough of this nonsense with the scar. Engage and destroy. Leave no survivors. An example is needed. Deploy soldiers at first light. Attack at dawn. Keter vows, Prime Minister." At the bottom of the page, the official seal of the Prime Minister had been imprinted.
"An arrow strike carried it. It landed on one of the roosts we use for our birds while in the field."
Presselin was breathing hard. He must have run the whole way.
"This one just arrived a few minutes ago. I read the message, saw what it meant, and came directly here."
Araxin Dresch nodded, reading the message again.
"This was one of our birds?"
"It must have been. According to the trainer who watched it land, it flew in from the south."
Presselin gave him a look.
"You're worried it might not be genuine? That it might be a scar trick?"
"It had crossed my mind."
"It bears Vowse's seal. How could they get their hands on that?"
Dresch shook his head.
"I don't want to take anything for granted where the scar are concerned."
"But what reason would they have for inviting an attack on their fortifications? What would be the point? We outnumber them 5-1, and they're cut off from their homeland and any reinforcements. It doesn't make any sense."
"Doesn't it?"
Araxin Dresch wondered. That princess was bold in a way few he had encountered had even thought of being. Still, his subordinate had a point. Whatever else might or might not be true, there was no denying that the strength of the Federation advance force was far superior to that of the Scar. And there was no denying the authenticity of the message. The seal was genuine, and the handwriting was Vowse's, even if the decision seemed a departure from what he expected of the normally cautious-to-a-fault Prime Minister. But there was also the matter of the duty he owed to those who commanded him. If he was given an order, he was expected to obey it. Vowse had put him in his present situation exactly because he had a history of doing what he was told without arguing or complaining. And now seemed a bad time to change that. Besides, if he was to be completely honest with himself, he wanted the scar dead and buried too. He wanted them gone from his life and from his country. The longer they stayed around, the more uncomfortable he felt. Smash them now, as ordered, and the discomfort and threat would both go away.
"Find Murien," he ordered. "Order a mobilization of the transports and warships for 2 hours before dawn. We will board just before sunrise and set out for the Scar fortifications. We'll come at them on the flanks and roll them up from either side. Flash rips and cannons from the air, then soldiers on the ground to finish the job. Leave one company here to ward against the river crossing. Although I cannot imagine anyone navigating the Myrmidon in its present condition. Now go!"
He watched as Presselin and his companions hurried away, Idaeus already giving orders and gesturing for quick action. Araxin Dresch shook his head. Quick action wasn't needed now. It might not even be needed later. Quick thinking, maybe, if matters took a dramatic turn. The Federation commander yawned. He needed to get some sleep, but that wasn't likely to happen any time soon. He never slept more than a couple of hours a night when he was in the field. But he might be home sooner than he expected if their strike on the morrow did the damage he expected, and he could catch up on his sleep then. Still, it was never a good idea to anticipate success. Fate had a way of fooling you when you did. and never in a pleasant way.
He stood for a few moments longer, watching Preslin and then looking off toward the far bank of the river once more. Watch fires weren't even lit yet. The gloom of night was approaching, a mistiness rising off the warm earth and a steady drop in temperature partnered to form a heavy broom that was steadily thickening. He couldn't see any sign of movement among the Scar ranks. He was struck by a disconcerting suspicion that his enemy had simply disappeared. He signalled to Rijer and Anstas.
"Let's go have a look at our airships and make sure they're ready for what's to come."
Without waiting for a reply, he departed the hilltop and moved toward the airfield farther inland. As always, movement helped ease his momentary concerns. His worries faded along with the last few rays of sunlight, and night settled in. At exactly 2 hours before dawn, the night still black, beneath a heavy layer of storm clouds and the air chill and smelling of rain, both companies that made up the Federation Advance Force began to mobilize. The men and women who filled their ranks woke quietly, dressed in darkness, armed themselves, and moved into previously designated positions on either side of the airfield, back where their huge transport and sleek black warships awaited boarding. They did so swiftly and efficiently, well trained for such contingencies, so all knew in advance what to expect and how to behave. 1/3 of those assembled were dispatched to staff the defensive lines along the south bank of the Myrmidon, there to settle in and keep watch for any sort of counter-strike by the Scar, either before or during the Federation attack. The orders had been given, and the entire advance force was already anticipating an end to the Scar threat. Across the river, everything was quiet. Watchfires burned, but otherwise there was no sign of activity. The arrival of the anticipated rainstorm had blocked the light of moon and stars, and now the first raindrops were beginning to fall. Standing with sub-commanders Croy and Preslin, First Commander Dresch glanced at the sky and momentarily considered holding off until the storm had passed, even if it meant attacking in daylight. But at the end of his deliberation he brushed aside his concerns. A little rain would hardly interfere with the manoeuvring of his warships or the use of his flash rips, and the storm might even pass by entirely in the next 2 hours. But things did not work out that way. The storm struck, with an hour still left before sunrise, and his soldiers not yet aboard their transports. And the rain was heavy, a deluge that drenched everyone to the skin. Winds howled, and the waters of the Myrmidon churned wildly, and the storm did not pass on as hoped, but hung around for another hour. It was still pouring when the soldiers were given orders to board, and the slow, steady process of bringing nearly 4,000 men aboard transports and warships commenced. Croy and Preslin took command of one company each, boarding separate transports to be with their men, leaving Araxin Dresch standing alone with Anstas and Rija. The first commander would wait until the other airships were launched and then follow in his own much smaller craft, observing the attack from this side of the river. For the remainder of the fleet it would be a swift crossing to meet the Scar enemy. The warships would swing around to the ends of the defensive line and roll it up, with weapons from the air. Transports would then fly farther inland to selected landing sites to unload their foot soldiers so they could pin the hapless Scar between themselves and the river. In the end, the entire enemy force would be annihilated. It was the plan Dresch had determined had the best chance of success. Except he was wrong. The Scar were one step ahead of him. The transports, slow and ponderous, were to lift off first, so that they could get underway and reach the river just as the warships came up toward them on either side. But as the first of the transports, the one that sub-commander Idaeus Preslin had chosen to board, rose into the clouded, rain-filled sky and reached an altitude of just under 1,000 feet, its diapson crystal-powered engines began to fail. They did so without warning, and not all at once, so that the airship lurched ahead for a few minutes longer, shuddering as it tried to stay aloft, but by then the vessel was lost from view to those still on the ground, hidden by low-hanging clouds and engulfed by the rainstorm's deluge. One by one, its engines ceased functioning. But the vessel continued forward under the faltering power of a sole remaining engine until that one, too, failed entirely, and the airship plummeted into the murky waters of the Myrmidon. It struck with stunning force, and hundreds were killed by the impact alone. Others made it into the river and were quickly caught up in the pool of the rapids and drowned. Of those who stayed aloft, a few lost their sense of direction, swam to the wrong bank, and died on its shores. Idaeus Preselin was among them. Scar soldiers, who cared nothing for his rank or his value to them, hauled him from the water, spread-eagled him on the rain-soaked earth, and cut him to pieces. Of those few who made it back to the south shore, no more than 200 of the nearly 1,500 who have filled the ship's hold found the Federation encampment in chaos. The remainder of the Federation airships had either tumbled from the sky or exploded shortly after their thrusters were engaged. No one knew the actual cause, although educated guesses were that either the diapson crystals in use had overheated due to a blockage of their pass tube exhausts, or the replacement crystals stored in the holds of the airships had ruptured. In either case, the consequences were the same. Every remaining vessel either caught fire amid incendiary explosions that engulfed and destroyed them while they were still on the ground, or lost power when their engines failed on liftoff and crashed. First Commander Araxin Dresch watched in horror and disbelief as the first of the transports lost power and fell away into the river, and as the remainder of his fleet turned to tinder and ash when they began to explode. He was in a daze when his guards dragged him to safety. The 4,000 men and women aboard those transports and warships were killed in minutes. Only a handful escaped. The carnage was indescribable. Some of those caught in the conflagration that engulfed the warships fought their way free of their doomed vessels while on fire, burning as they sought a safety that couldn't be found. Some fell out of the sky, thrown from the transports, helpless to save themselves. But most died while still aboard, unable to get clear. Araxin Dresch watched and tried to process what he was seeing and could not. Any semblance of command disappeared. All around him his soldiers were dying by the hundreds, and his airships were falling to pieces. Of Preselin and Croy he knew nothing. Their fates were already decided, but he was unaware of this. At the river's edge a new battle was beginning, but the Federation First Commander could not know that it was between those Federation soldiers manning the defensive line and the unfortunate survivors of the first transport who had made it clear of their fallen airship and swum for safety. The latter were mistakenly seen as members of a Scar attack, and summarily slaughtered by their fellows. In the darkness, the smoke and ash, and the rain and mist, it was impossible to tell who anyone was. Federation soldiers were killing one another because no one knew who was friend or foe. By the time anyone realized the mistake, most of those around them were already dead. Screams filled the night. Howls of despair and cries for help rose from everywhere, and amid the chaos the terrifying explosions continued, while the blanketing hiss of the heavy rain fell. Confusion was rampant, and order broke down at every turn. Survivors had no clear idea of what had happened and were seeing enemies everywhere they looked, even when they looked into the faces of their fellows. And then the Scar attacked. Coldray led the assault from the left flank of the Federation encampment, while Arjin led the attack from the right. The Scar had come across the Myrmidon in separate units of 200 soldiers each at dusk the day before, one choosing a point of crossing more than 10 miles downstream, and the other crossing 10 miles upstream from their enemy, doing so in small numbers so there would be no chance of discovery. When night arrived, both units had moved into place, so they were well behind Federation scouts, watching the river and its banks, in place for what they already knew was going to happen. It had been Cole's plan to send First Commander Dresch the false message. He had stolen a seal and a handwritten note off the Prime Minister's desk during his visit a week earlier, and he could forge a false response accurately. Stealing one of the Federation's arrow shrikes from their pens, which were left unguarded in the false belief that no one would attempt the theft of a bird, was simple enough when you could render yourself invisible. Arjin had approved his plan. She knew from experience that if there was to be a Federation attack, it would either come at dawn or, if the approaching storm settled in, be postponed until the weather improved. The Scar only needed to be in place and ready to thwart it. It was a gamble to send soldiers across the river and set them in place the night before, but a gamble worth taking. It was a stroke of luck that the First Commander had chosen to ignore what should have been common sense and engaged while the storm was still in progress. The concealment offered by the clouds and rain had worked in favour of the Scar, giving them exactly the cover they had sought. During the night, a A handful of scouts led by Coldray had crept into the camp, invisible to the eyes of the few Federation soldiers who were keeping watch or loitering about the airships. Boarding the warships unseen, they had blocked the pass tubes so they would overheat, and replaced all but a few of the sound diapson crystals in the transports with ones that were cracked. It had only required that the engines be engaged and the thrusters for lifting off be fired for the crystals either to explode as they overheated or simply to fail mere minutes after liftoff. After the airships were destroyed, chaos enveloped the Federation encampment, and the chain of command that all armies relied on crumbled completely. The orders Argent d'Amphir gave were clear. The Scar would emerge from hiding once the explosions were complete, swoop down on the disoriented and frightened soldiers, and begin the slaughter. The orders given to the separate units of the advance force were simple. Everyone found in the camp was to be killed. Not a single Federation soldier, man or woman, injured or healthy, was to be spared. The destruction was to be complete. An object lesson to the Federation that they had underestimated the power and experience of the Scar, and that in spite of superior numbers they could not save themselves. Their false confidence in the strength of their army had undone them, and they would be undone again if the Scar chose to come after them.
"What do you anticipate this will achieve?" Coldray had asked her as they split up to lead their separate units. "Besides the obvious, of course." "You're hoping for something more, aren't you?"
He was correct, as usual. Insightful, her penetrator. She had smiled and nodded.
"I want my father to acknowledge my ability to lead," she admitted. "I want him to see how invaluable I am. I want whatever doubts Sten Orr has created with his treacherous reports to be proved false. I want to persuade him to place me in command of the large army he will most certainly be bringing with him, and allow me to finish what I started." She paused. "I want to keep him from finding a reason to dismiss me as his legitimate child and heir. Most of all, I want to reduce the influence of the pretender who has taken my mother's place in his bed."
"Which you think will happen if you succeed?"
"The pretender has sought to put an end to my mother from the beginning, so undermining her is necessary. A victory here, resulting in a new home for the Scar people, would negate her influence considerably."
She paused, seized his shoulders, and looked him in the eye.
"What other reasonable choice do I have?"
Coldray knew better than to attempt an answer to that question. Once Arjin had made up her mind about something this extreme, it was best to just stay out of her way. Besides, she might well be right in her assessment of the king's response. Cor d'Amphir was a hard man, but he valued success and loyalty. If his daughter could give him that, he might forgive her for losing Paranor and its treasures. He might accept everything that had happened since their arrival as the natural course of things, and look to the promise of what was to be gained if he let his daughter follow through. They parted company, then, each going to a separate command to prepare for the events that would follow with the coming dawn. And now those events had come to pass, and Argent d'Amphir led her soldiers into battle from the right perimeter of the Federation encampment, blades drawn and ready. Those Federation soldiers still alive, dazed and disoriented and in many cases already injured, put up little resistance. They died by the dozens, most cut down before they even knew what was happening. The rain continued to fall in sheets, and the ground was soon soaked with commingled water and blood. The Scar worked their way through the survivors with mechanical precision, maintaining lines that swept up everyone in their path. When the lines met, they split apart again, and one half of each unit were sent down to the river to attack the defenders entrenched at its edge. Coming up on the Federation soldiers from behind, they found them still waiting for orders, and, unable to see their attackers until they were upon them, these unfortunates were dispatched as swiftly and thoroughly as their fellows. Soon the Federation camp was growing steadily quieter, and the presence of those soldiers still living was diminishing. The sounds of death and dying faded, and only the pounding of the rain and the crackle of the flames engulfing the Federation airships remained. Arjin was standing at the center of the carnage, watching as the last few of the enemy soldiers were sent to their deaths, when one of her junior officers appeared.
"Princess,"
he said, dropping to one knee.
"Kayricha,"
she acknowledged, giving him her hand to kiss. She saw the warmth in his eyes as his gaze lifted to meet hers, saw the flush in his rain-streaked face. She never forgot a soldier's name, and such a small thing carried a great reward.
"We have a prisoner," Kerija said, rising as she gestured. "His guards fought hard to protect him from us, but failed. We think he might be the army's leader."
"The first commander?"
"He won't say, but we think so."
"Show me," she said. They walked through the killing ground to the back of the encampment, where a small cluster of soldiers had gathered about a man who had been forced to his knees in the mud. His head was hanging down, his hair fallen forward over his face, and his hands tied behind his back. She took it all in and then turned to Kerija.
"Find Koldre. Ask him to attend me."
Kerija hurried away. Arjin stood looking at the prisoner. He was beaten and humiliated, unable even to look at her. She did not know if this was Araxin Dresh. She needed Cole to confirm it. He had accumulated knowledge of such things from his time in the Four Lands previous to her arrival. She glanced toward the river while she waited, noting a sudden absence of sound. The killing was over. The battle was finished. She considered what she had done, but did not regret it. Minutes passed, and then Koldre appeared. He was soaked to the skin and covered in blood, but his gaze was steady. She pointed at the prisoner, and the penetrator bent to lift the other's chin, studied his face a moment, and then stepped back.
"First Commander Dresh," he said to the man,
"you seem dispirited."
The prisoner said nothing. He was clearly waiting to be executed, expecting it, perhaps even welcoming it. Arjin debated. Should she let him live? If she did, he would return to Arishag and report on what had happened here, a witness to the carnage. And a first-hand report would carry weight with those who heard it. It would serve as a testament to what the Scar could do to a superior force. But it would also provide Dresh with an opportunity to set the record straight. He would tell of the false message he had received. He would reveal how a trap had been set to destroy the entire advance force by luring it into an ill-advised attack. Or if he chose to keep all of that to himself, to avoid the attendant shame it would heap on him, he would likely be executed for acting precipitously. Or executed simply to provide an example of what could happen to those who failed so badly. Nothing good would happen to him if he lived, and the benefit to her would be negligible. She looked down on his broken body with a twinge of pity. Better to end it here. She nodded to Kerija, gesturing toward his sword. He gave her a questioning look, then saw the determination in her eyes and drew his blade. Stepping to one side of Dresh, he lifted his weapon overhead and in a single swift stroke brought it down again. Araxin Dresh's head toppled away, and his body slumped forward.
"Finish up," she ordered Cole. "Gather up the bodies and burn them. Strip the airships of anything useful. Bring our aqua swifts over to carry back our soldiers. Tonight, we celebrate the beginning of the end of the Federation."
25. Shay Umsford stared at the gambler who called himself Rokan Arnius, and who now claimed to be involved in an enterprise that would change the world, and wondered if the man was perhaps delusional. His strengths seemed to revolve around gaming and an ability to relieve almost anyone willing to play with him of their credits. And he was in possession of some sort of machine that might conceivably do almost anything, given its strange configuration. Nothing the boy had seen or heard so far had done much to convince him that this whole business wasn't simply a lot of hot air and unreasonable expectations. Not for the first time, he thought it might be time to fold up his tent, pocket the credits the man had already paid him, and slip away into the night.
"I see doubt in your eyes, young Shay Umsford," the other said suddenly, as if reading his thoughts. "You think I am a braggart or a fool, a man somehow self-deceived into believing the impossible. You think you have heard nothing but words and have seen no proof of anything, am I right?"
The boy shuffled his feet, measuring the distance to the doors through which they had entered earlier and judging how far it was from there to the street outside. He shrugged.
"If you were me, what would you think?"
Rokan did not laugh. Instead, he gestured toward a bench to one side of the strange machine.
"Sit with me a few minutes before you finish passing judgment. Let me try to convince you I am more than my words would suggest."
He moved over to the bench, leaving a clear path to the doorway leading out of the cavernous chamber. He sat and looked back at Shay, who was still standing where he had been left. The boy hesitated, then joined him on the bench. Rokan studied him a moment.
"Do you know why I brought you to Arishag with me? I mean, why I really brought you?"
Shay shook his head.
"Probably not. For all the reasons I told you before, of course. Those weren't lies I spoke, they were promises. But while they were honest, they weren't the entire truth. Tell me, does your name mean anything at all to you?"
Another shake of his head. But Shay was wondering by now where this was leading.
"And you don't know how you got it? No one ever told you?"
"I'm an orphan. No one ever told me anything. I never knew my parents. I was on the streets before I was 5 years old. I had some people who helped me, a friend or two, to protect me. I learned how to look after myself, otherwise I don't know anything about my name."
Rokan sat back, drawing one leg up on the bench and placing it between them in a gesture that suggested both a distancing and a reflection.
"Your name is a famous one, my young friend. You are named after one of the most important young men ever to walk the four lands. You must have heard of the Wars of the Races, of the Warlock Lord and his skull-bearers?"
"Some. Not much. That was a long time ago."
Rokan's eyes assumed a faraway look.
"A very long time ago. But I know the history well. It is a tribute to my people's culture that we consider it important to preserve our history through storytelling, and we keep those stories close as the generations pass. I am of rover blood, all the way back to the time when my ancestors survived by their wits and their quick hands, and later by their skill as builders of airships. They mostly inhabited the Westland then, and many still do now. They still build the best airships in all the four lands, claims by the Federation notwithstanding. When the first Sheyonsred walked the four lands, he came out of a tiny village called Shady Vale, located just below the Rainbow Lake, and he walked in the company of one of my more famous ancestors, a man named Panamon Creel. Together they stood against the terrible threat of the Warlock Lord and his skull-bearers, a threat that would have destroyed everything of value in all these lands and would likely have put an end to the world we live in now."
"So the Warlock Lord was real?"
Shay was still doubtful.
"And all that stuff about the War of the Races really happened?"
His companion nodded.
"All of it. But here's what you need to know. I don't believe in chance, and I don't believe in luck, but I do believe in fate. It was no accident that Panamon Creel and Shay Ongsford ended up as companions on that fateful journey to the Skull Kingdom all those years ago. Fate caused them to meet and made them friends, friends who would do whatever it took to help each other. It kept them together long enough for each to save the life of the other and the lives of many more besides."
He paused, then reached out and tapped Shay on the shoulder. "It was fate that brought you to me as well, don't you see? It was fate that placed you in that gambling room, drew my attention, and made me decide to take a chance that you were as ready and able as you appeared. Fate persuaded me you were the one to extricate me from a somewhat dangerous situation, and fate that convinced me to bring you here. I believe that. You and I are meant to be partners and comrades in a grand adventure." By now he was so wound up, so enthusiastic about fate and its complicity in his life, that Shay was left speechless. Homeless for so long, used to being dependent on nothing and no one, Shay was not much of a believer in fate. So while this wild-eyed gambler might have certainly played an important role in his life, Shay was much less sure. His experience had taught him that if you wanted things to improve, you had to do it on your own. Rokan was staring at him with a look that bordered on amusement.
"I know what you were thinking. You think I've lost my mind. You think I'm a dreamer or a fool, or worse. But if you stick with me, my young lad, you will find out that what I have just told you is correct. Now then, are you ready to hear about my grand scheme? My plans for changing our world and our people? Or are you just going to walk out the door?"
For a moment, Shay knew he was going to make the second choice. And then a bit of movement caught his eye, and when he looked over, there was Sela, easing along through the shadows on the far side of the room. In the excitement and trauma of the fight to escape their attackers, he had forgotten her. But seeing her again, catching the light dancing in her strange eyes and the smile that curved her lips, he was reminded again of how entranced he was with her. He was not foolish enough to think that it could ever come to anything, but he was also unable to resist his infatuation. And he didn't want to give up his chance to spend time with her just yet. He didn't think Rokan presented any danger in spite of his wild ideas. What could it hurt to stick around for just another day or so? It would be time spent in the company of Sela, a pleasure he very much desired. Suddenly she was there next to him, her golden eyes fixed on him, her slender body leaning close. He stayed where he was, as her face neared his, all but hypnotized by those eyes. A rumbling sound filled the air as she pressed close. Was she purring? Then she placed her face next to his cheek, and licked him with her rough tongue in long, slow, languid laps.
"Enough, Sela," Rokan snapped. "He is aware of your affection for him, if not for the cause. Back away."
The Fae did so reluctantly, her gaze drifting away. In less than 5 seconds she had disappeared once more. Shay brushed at his cheek in spite of himself.
"Where does she go when she does that?"
Rokan shrugged.
"Not very far. She stays close unless I tell her otherwise. She's watching you right now. You just can't see her."
The boy looked around carefully. His companion was right. He couldn't see her.
"Like a moorcat," he ventured.
"Which is not surprising, since she has moorcat blood."
He held up his hands quickly.
"Don't ask, at least not now. Are we partners or not? You still haven't said."
"All right. For the moment, at least, we're partners. But if you can't convince me that whatever it is you intend is worth the time and effort, the partnership is over."
In the shadows across the room, something moved, catching his attention.
"She's exploring," Rokan offered. "She does it all the time. The cat in her, I suppose. Anyway, let me continue with what I started. I still owe you an explanation about what we are going to attempt. I will keep nothing from you, nor use any deceptions to convince you of falsehoods. Just hear me out."
Shay Ulmsford nodded and gave Rokan his full attention. He had already decided it was the least he could do. Sitting alone in Driska Ark's darkened cottage while Tavo Kanin slept in the next room, Clesia Porse reached an epiphany. She had returned to the house with Tavo after the confrontation in the forest imp's underground lair, enraged at losing Tasha to this creature and his companions, but confident about getting the girl back. It was only a matter of discovering where she had gone and what she intended to do next. Tavo had wanted to set off in pursuit at once, but Clesia knew better. The elf and the blade both had the use of magic, and while Tasha was weakened and disoriented for the moment, she would not remain that way for long. Together the three might be a match for her, although having Tavo stand with her in a confrontation appealed to her. He had powerful magic at his command, but he was also borderline insane. His ability to do much more than strike out blindly was likely to overwhelm whatever common sense remained to him. She might have been better off getting rid of him, but she still could not shake the feeling that somehow he would prove useful. He could still be a pawn in this game, only his place on the board and his purpose remained to be determined. On arriving back at the cottage, she had made him eat and drink a portion of bread and ale, and then sent him off to bed. He had been more than willing to obey after unknowingly ingesting the potion she had mixed in, a drug that left him weak and disoriented. Because his behavior was so unpredictable, the trick was to keep him under control until she could figure out what to do with him. But at the moment she needed to think things through, starting with the odd demise of the forest imp. That one still troubled her. An ancient creature with centuries of life behind him and no reason to give his life for a young mortal girl, yet he had done so. Why had he made such a choice? Why had he deliberately chosen to sacrifice himself? That would be impossible for most. But he had managed it effortlessly. What had persuaded him that this was a good idea? Why not just give the girl up and be done with it? She would likely never know the answers to these questions, and she didn't like mysteries. So she shifted her thinking to the three who had escaped her, the ones she intended to track down. They would band together, but where would they go with Driska locked away inside Paranor? She frowned, the wrinkles on her aged face deepening. A Highlander, an elf, and a young girl from the deep Westland. They had nothing in common but the druid and the girl's brother. Would they risk coming back for Tavo after having just escaped Clizia? She didn't think so, not without help and a plan for besting her in a fight. Would they go to Lee? To Arbalon? It was easy enough to find out, of course. She had marked the girl, and unless Tasha had discovered it and found a way to remove it, she could be located easily enough. Suddenly she had a suspicion she knew exactly where they would go. Paranor, or where Paranor had once stood. Driska might even have called them there. Somehow he might have found a way to contact them, or maybe just the girl, to tell them what had happened, which meant that he would know Clizia no longer had the upper hand, because now Tasha Kanan was free. And if he had managed by now to recover the Black Elfstone, which was exactly what he had done. Of course he had. Why else would he continue to ignore her? Yet he wasn't back in the Four Lands, and if he had the power of the Elfstone at his command, he would have returned at once, so maybe he didn't have it, but only knew that she didn't. She shook her head in frustration. The entire business was a confused mess, and she needed to do something to clear it up before she could be sure of anything. She rose and walked outside and stood on the steps leading out to the roadway, staring into the darkness. If Driska had found the Black Elfstone, why was he still inside the keep? Why hadn't he used the stone's magic to return Paranor to the Four Lands and free himself? She needed to answer both questions before she did anything further. How could she do that? But then, she realized suddenly, she knew. A smile crossed her sour features, shedding years from her face as it broadened. The scry orb. If she wanted to get a peek at how things stood, she could use the orb to summon Driska, find out where he was, listen to what he might say. His situation would reveal itself, and then she would know what to do next. She went into the cottage and took out the orb from where she had hidden it. Then she stopped by Tavo's bedroom and peered through the doorway to ensure he was still asleep. He was. His breathing deep and even, so she pulled his door closed and went back down the hall. Once outside again, she sat in the wicker chair and willed the orb to do her bidding. Instantly it brightened. She commanded the magic to connect to its twin, readying herself for the confrontation that would follow. A few seconds passed. A minute. 2 minutes. She grew uneasy. Then, all at once, Driska was magnified in the magic's glow, facing her from within its bright wrapping. "Clizia," he said in what seemed a pleased tone, "I thought you had abandoned me." "I made you an offer. It was yours to accept or decline. Have you come to a decision?" She took quick note of his surroundings, the grey tones and haze. The dimness of the light surrounding him and the stone-and-mortar walls looming in the background told her all she needed to know. He was still trapped inside Paranor.
"I have," he acknowledged. "I'm afraid I have to decline."
"You do know what will happen to the girl, don't you?"
He shook his head.
"Not any more. Nor, I think, do you. Things have changed a bit, haven't they?"
A cold certainty swept through her. She tried not to show anything in her expression. He knew she'd lost Tasha, which meant he knew she no longer had a bargaining chip with which to persuade him to return. She gave a small shrug.
"I admit she's run off. I'll find her and bring her back quickly enough." She paused. "I think we both know she won't be meeting with you, however. You're still trapped in Paranor. Do you really like it in there so much?"
Driska shook his head.
"I was puzzled for a time, but now I figured out the solution. I won't be here much longer."
He leaned forward to be close when he spoke next, his voice lowered.
But there's time for me to free myself now, isn't there? Tasha has friends to help her, and you won't be finding her all that easily. Your hold over me is gone, Clesia. If I were you, I would find the deepest hole in all the four lands in which to hide. I would be covering up and praying hard I don't find you, because I will be looking very hard. You don't scare me, Driska, she snapped. He leaned back, and just before the scry orb went dark, he said, I'm coming for you.
You have to understand, Rokan Anias began, still seated beside Shay. I've spent a good many years of my life just knocking about, trying to stay out of trouble and mostly finding it anyway. I didn't have much direction in my life, which wasn't the fault of my parents, who tried to steer me right. But they had five other children, and I was young, headstrong and eager to experience everything I could.
Oh, brother, Shay thought. Now he's going to tell me the story of his life.
But this time it appeared Rokan couldn't read his thoughts. He continued on.
I was making my money in gambling halls by then. I was good at games of chance. I had a knack for knowing what to do and when to do it. I'd left home while still young and gone east, to the Southland cities. No one knew me there. No one knew of my reputation. The gamers in the big cities were easy pickings. They took one look at me and saw an easy mark. They thought they knew how to play, but they were amateurs next to me. I took them for everything I could wherever I went, and just before I could build a damaging reputation, I picked up my stakes and moved on. I lived frugally, sort of, if you don't count the women and the drink, saving everything else for when I would need it. I didn't know when that would be, but I believed I would find it one day. He paused. And then I met Sela. You've already heard a little of the story. I found her locked away in a cage in an outlying village in the upper borderlands, east of Varfleet. I was travelling through, saw the cage and asked what was in it. The villagers didn't know. All they knew was that they'd never seen anything like it, so that meant it was bad, and probably dangerous, especially since it reminded them of moorcats. But when I looked into that cage, I saw something beautiful. I don't know how they ever got her in there in the first place, but she couldn't get out. I found out later it was the iron that bound her. Iron saps the strength from some of the Fae, and Sela couldn't break free.
So you let her out,
Shay said, interested now that the story was about Sela.
And you've been together ever since.
We weren't together at first. After I let her out, she raced off into the forest. It was the dead of night, so there was no one around to see it. I went back to bed and woke the next morning to find the village in an uproar. I pretended to be just as surprised as everyone else, stayed around long enough to enjoy a bit of lunch and left. I never saw a sign of Sela after that. Eventually I just chalked it up to another strange episode in my life.
Shay started to ask a question, but Rokan quickly held up his hand in a cautionary gesture.
"Bear with me," he said. "I haven't finished."
Sela was suddenly beside him once more, appearing out of nowhere to nuzzle his hand. He stroked her silky hair in response. Her golden eyes found Shay, and her purring was so loud it seemed to cause the air to vibrate. In that moment, she seemed more cat than woman. Rokan shook his head and smiled.
Several months passed, and I was working the smaller cities below Lee when I got myself in trouble. Overstayed my welcome without intending to, and a bunch of dissatisfied players who had lost a king's ransom to me earlier came searching. They caught me unaware and hauled me off to the woods, where they were going to hang me. They had the rope and everything. Unfortunately for them, they made a mistake by choosing to finish me off deep in the woods. If they'd hung me in my rooms or dragged me out onto the village green, I'd be dead. But Sela had been following me around all those weeks, watching me, studying me, maybe. She shot out of the trees like the mad wild thing she sometimes is, and those men broke and ran so fast they must have set new land speed records. She slapped a few of the slower ones around, but let them all go in the end. Then she chewed through my ropes, quicker for her that way rather than using those dainty fingers, and off we went. I didn't know what she wanted from me at first, but she made it known soon enough. She wanted a companion. Well, she wanted me for a companion at any rate, so that was how we ended up travelling together, right up until now.
There were a whole bunch of questions Shay wanted to ask about Rogan and Sela's relationship, but none of them seemed quite appropriate, or any of his business. It was enough that they were partners, and now he was being asked to join them. Was this good or bad? He couldn't tell yet.
"But none of this explains what we're doing here now, or how that machine is going to change the world," he pointed out instead.
"Prologue," the other said, smiling. "I like my stories complete. But here's the answer to your question. I stumbled on Tyndall during my travels. I found him here in Arishak after some acquaintances had told me there was an old man working with diapson crystals in new and unusual ways. Mostly the Federation employs the crystals in weapons and vehicles, airships and flash rips and the like. War equipment that serves only a single purpose. Tyndall thought that was insane. He thought the power of the crystals could serve other uses, peaceful uses. He thought this fixation on war was leading us down a dangerous path that could well cause another great war."
Shay shook his head.
"I didn't think anyone had that kind of power anymore. I was told the great wars were the result of massive explosions, ones that destroyed entire cities,
and poisoned the air and water and food and practically everything else. Sickness was deliberately introduced into whole populations to wipe them out. And no, we aren't yet at that point, but we could get there. Tyndall believes we aren't that far away from seeing it happen. The Federation is a militant power with ambitious plans for dominating the other races and occupying all of the four lands and perhaps beyond, and their leaders reflect that ambition. So something has to be done to blunt its direction. Tyndall decided a while back to see if he couldn't find a way."
"So he's a scientist," the boy interrupted. "Like in the old days, only with diapson crystals?"
"A fair description.
He has developed some amazing inventions. He invented a device that allows people to talk to each other from miles off through hand-sized units. Voice messaging, he calls it. But the Federation knows about it and wants to use it for military purposes, not for public communications. It's still in the improvement stages at the moment, but it won't be long before it's ready."
"So why did he tell them about it in the first place?" "He thought it would be a good idea at the time. He thought they would listen to him when he suggested public communications. He thought wrong. When he realized what they intended, he refused to give them any plans. That's probably why he's locked up just now. He didn't do what they wanted."
"But they don't know about this," Shay pointed toward the machine. "How did he keep that a secret?"
"He doesn't know where it is."
Shay stared at him.
"How can that be? He invented it, didn't he? Whatever it is."
Rokan stood.
"Long story. Come with me."
He walked over to the strange machine, with Shay following. Together they stood next to it, gazing up at all the odd components. The machine was huge, at least as big as a small house, if somewhat more strangely shaped. There was the funnel with its mouth pointed skyward, a cluster of wheels and gears, pass tubes of varying sizes, light sheaths that were furled but connected to the tubes by radian drawers, catch basins closed and sealed, and cables, wires and connector tubes going everywhere.
"This is Annabelle,"
Rokan said softly, placing one hand on the side of the machine as if to pet it. Shay glanced over at him.
"You named it?"
"Seemed the right thing to do, given what she is."
The boy frowned.
"And are you going to tell me what she is?"
Rokan turned to him and placed both hands on his shoulders.
"Annabelle can control the weather."
Shay gave an audible sigh. Now quite certain that Rokan Arnias was crazy. 26. Tavel Kanin woke while it was still dark, confused and logy, his thinking clouded and his head pounding. He was not feeling well, and he wondered if something he had eaten had sickened him. But he had no memory of having eaten, or, if he had, what he had eaten, so there was nothing to be done about it. His thoughts turned instantly to Tasha and her escape. He was riddled with anger and frustration at the thought that he might have to track her down all over again. The old woman had tried to help, but her help had been insufficient, and now he was wondering if there was any reason to stay with her any longer. He sat up slowly and waited for his head to clear enough that he could attempt to leave his bed. He remembered the old woman bringing him back to the cottage after Tasha had fled and that creature that had helped her had killed itself. He remembered the old woman giving him medicine to help him sleep. He seemed to recall her saying she would help him find his sister, but that might have been his imagination. After all, his magic was much stronger than hers. She was so ancient she could barely move around. No, it was best if he thanked her, bid her a quick goodbye, and went on his way. He wondered suddenly about Fluken. It had been a while since his companion had spoken to him. A while, in fact, since he had even appeared. Tabo wondered suddenly if Fluken was gone, if he had tired of waiting and simply decided to go off on his own. But Fluken would never do that. Fluken would always be there for him, no matter what. Nevertheless, he grew nervous, thinking about life without his only friend. So finally he dragged himself from his bed and stumbled over to the door. It was closed, but not all the way, so he peeked out to see what might be waiting for him. There was no one there, and the cottage was as dark as the night. He paused for a few moments longer, just to be sure it was safe, then crept from the room. Down the hall he slipped, quiet as a mouse, afraid of what might be lurking in the shadows. He had no reason to be afraid, of course. He was a match for anything, his magic capable of snuffing out a threat as quickly as breath could a candle. He was invincible, and that was why Tasha was doomed. When he reached the front room, he could see the old woman through the window, sitting in her high-back wicker chair on the porch, staring into the night. At first he thought to turn around and slip out the other way, but he was afraid if he did that, Fluken might not see him go. Besides, he wasn't afraid of this old woman, was he? Her name was... For a moment he couldn't remember. Then it came to him. Clizia. Clizia Pors. Yes, that was it. And no, he wasn't afraid of her, or anyone for that matter. Why should he be? He walked out onto the porch and stood looking at her. She turned her head to look back at him, and there was a coldness reflected in her eyes. "You thought about running off, but you shouldn't do that," she said. "I would have known the moment you tried and stopped you." He stared at her in surprise, startled that she could somehow know what he was doing.
"I'm not afraid of you,"
he snapped. She rose to face him, taking her time.
"Nor should you be," she replied.
Her voice was suddenly warm and reassuring.
"I'm not your enemy. I'm your friend. I'm the one who is going to find Tasha for you, and her friends as well, all of whom are plotting against you."
Tavo nodded slowly.
"They are, aren't they? Plotting with her. She wants to hurt me. She's afraid of me."
The old woman smiled, her sharp eyes holding his fast, trapping him like a fly in a spider's web.
"We have to do something about them. We have to take them away from her. Then she will belong to you again."
"I know. They have to be taken away."
He understood, without entirely knowing why.
"How do we do that?"
She stepped close.
"We'll go where they are, and we'll kill them, Tavo. All of them. One at a time. You and I. I will be there to aid you, but the most important of them is the one you must kill first. Will you be able to do so? Will you be strong enough to kill someone who is just as dangerous as either you or I? Would you be afraid of someone like that?"
He shook his head.
"I'm not afraid of anyone. My magic protects me."
She reached out, took hold of his wrist and made him kneel beside her. She stroked his cheek gently. He was reminded of another woman's touch in that moment, but he could not think whom the woman was.
"I will help you," she whispered. "I will give you something even stronger than your wish song. I will give you a weapon nothing can stop. Would you like me to do that?"
"What weapon?"
"I will show you when there is daylight, and then you will practice with it. You will learn to use it. It will become a part of you. With this weapon and your wish-song magic, you will be invincible. No one will be able to stand against you. But you must listen to my instructions. You must let me teach you."
He nodded, his gaze gone blank and unseeing. He was seeing now with his ears, listening to the pleasant hum of her voice. He was feeling her presence, strong, reassuring and protective. There was no doubt in his mind that she wanted to help him. that she would help him. He only needed to listen to her. He only needed to pay attention.
"Tell me you will do as I say,"
she whispered once more, closer now, so close he